So I'm picking up on the theme of black holes. I usually put the title over here, don't I? Okay, so I put a little air quotes around observing, because a black hole is, of course, black. By definition, it's an event horizon and nothing can escape from it. So the only way really you might observe them is through Hawking radiation, right? Because that's the only thing that actually comes from a black hole. So it's more about being sneaky and about establishing what's not there and trying to get more precise about that. So so in essence, we see it by what it does to things around it. And what this leads us to is thinking about geodesics. So I know you'll have done some of this, but that's what I kind of want to go through, because either by, for example, one of the really most beautiful observations that just showed us that we had a supermassive black hole at the core of our galaxy, was actually done by watching stars that were zipping round really fast around nothing. Couldn't see what they were zipping around, at least initially. And so that's an example where you're looking at orbits of objects, right? Then for stellar-sized black holes, people are looking at the sort of very high energy photons that come from accretion disks in the vicinity of the stellar black hole. So that's another example, and that's again geodesics. And those are both sort of to do with orbits around the black hole. But then what we see, of course, photons as light coming from some strong gravity region. So that means we've also got to think about null geodesics and how they propagate near a black hole where space-time can be very strongly distorted. So it's really all about geodesics, one way or the other. So that's what I'm going to talk about first. And I'm going to focus mostly on Schwarzschild, because of course that is the easiest of all of the black holes. And whilst things qualitatively change with rotation, quantitatively change, the large amount of what you do for Schwarzschild is at least heuristically the same. And I put that because I'll probably use that abbreviation. Okay. So that's just to remind ourselves of the metric, right? So our geodesic equation, as you would have first seen it, is a second order ODE. So you parameterize your geodesic by some affine parameter tau. I mean, I, you know, I'm calling it Tao, which is suggestive of it being at least vaguely time-like, but so. But that's your second ordered ODE. Now, in fact, we rarely solve that. We usually use tricks to make it a bit simpler or a bit lower order. So, so one of these tricks, if you like, is suppose K mu is a killing vector. So what that means is that the symmetrized covariant derivative, again, now this is abstract index notation, of K with its index lowered vanishes. So we talked about killing vectors. I didn't write this equation explicitly, but if you haven't seen it, I leave it as an exercise to the reader. So, let's consider the contraction of K, the dot product, so to speak, of K with the tangent vector to our geodesic. Then this is because we've got a scalar, the dot product of K with X dot, my d by d tau is just the covariant derivative or partial derivative along the tangent vector x dot. But then you can see that when this covariant derivative hits each in turn, this vanishes because of the geodesic equation. And that vanishes because it's of the killing vector equation. Because by having two x dots there, you're symmetrizing. So what that means is that K dotted with x with the tangent vector is a constant. So we've now got a constant of motion. So we're quite used to this in physics. We identify symmetries, and symmetries are associated with constants, conserved charges. So if we have a symmetry of the metric, it means we're going to have something conserved along our geodesic. So let's go back to Schwarzschild. Schwarzschild has a lot of killing vectors, but I'm going to pick out two. So let me pick out the time-like vector. So that tells me that GTT x dot t is constant, or ft dot is some constant. So we label it E because our intuition is that something associated with the time-like direction is associated to energy in some way. That's why we label it E. Doesn't mean it's absolutely the energy, it's just it's a helpful label to give that constant. And then again, K is d by d phi, so that's a different killing vector. The metric doesn't depend on phi. So this tells me that r squared phi dot is also a constant. So that we are thinking of as angular momentum. So we've already got two constants of motion. Now, rather than sort of try to get more algebraically complex with zero additional physical insight, I'm going to use the spherical symmetry to say that if I start my geodesic in the equatorial plane, then it stays in the equatorial plane. So we see that, you can sort of see that, if you like, by just checking that original geodesic second order equation. If theta is pi on 2 and theta dot is 0, theta remains pi on 2, so theta double dot is 0. So in other words, we're kind of choosing the z-axis to have the geodesic. So in essence, I'm sort of trading, trying to keep a more general, you know, equation of motion where the geodesics kind of arc across in the sort of plane, arc across the black hole, sort of relative to some fiducial z, you know, axis, by just choosing this. So I'm sort of, that means that I only need to think about those two Hilling vectors. Then the other way, there is one more constant. If I look at the variation of the length of the tangent vector, that is, the rate of change of its length along the curve, when this covariant derivative hits g, gives me 0. And when the covariant derivative along the curve hits the tangent vector, it also gives me 0. So a bit similar to what I did with the Killing equation, except there it was the symmetrized derivative of the Killing vector that vanished. And here it's by definition for the metric connection. Grad on the metric vanishes. So that means this object here is also conserved. So I'm going to call that constant eta because it really takes two distinct values. If eta is 0, that means the tangent vector has 0 length, which means it's null. And if eta equals 1, because we can always kind of rescale our affine parameter, then that means that the length of the tangent vector is positive, which in plus, minus, minus, minus convention means it's time-like. Now, if you were really thinking about massive particles, you would probably want to relate the length of the tangent vector to the energy, but here we're just interested in geodesics. So we just say it's either 0, 1, or if you were interested in space-like geodesics, you'd take eta equal minus 1. But I'm interested in what happens in the vicinity of a black hole to matter and what happens to the light rays that come from near the black hole. So I'm just looking at these two examples. So that means we go we've set theta is pi on 2. We have replaced t dot by a constant and f of r. We've replaced phi dot by h and a function of r. So all that's left is r dot. And so this is what I get. So now it's a first order equation. It's non-linear, but it is just a first order equation. And it's actually one that we can rewrite in a form that is very familiar. And I'm just going to I can rewrite that as r dot squared plus v effective of r. Now, normally it would be a half r dot squared plus v effective, which would be sort of very much a sort of classical kinematic problem. You'd be relating the kinetic energy to a potential energy. I don't want factors of two floating around because I'll probably forget them. So I'm just multiplying through by two. So this v gives you an intuitive way of seeing what the orbits can be. So it's an effective potential for the motion in the radial direction. Let me just kind of label it. This part is just sort of setting the level. This part is the Newtonian potential. So if this is exactly, if you were doing orbits in Newtonian gravity, you would have that part. You'd also have the next part, which is like a sort of centrifugal term. So that would be the sort of repulsive effect you'd get from an orbital motion. It's this last part that you get when you have Einstein gravity. So intuitively, if you think about the sort of sizes of these, again, it's hard because you have to sort of put back C and everything. But this one is still, this one sort of stays relatively the same. But over here, your suppression is like the Schwarzschild radius of whatever you're looking at and the cube of whatever the orbit is. So this tends to be very small, except near a black hole. So I'm going to sketch. It's always good. I'm wondering if this is going to be a skill that kind of disappears because everyone just pops everything into, I don't know, what is it? The favorite thing on? Someone tell me, I don't know. I use Mathematica if I'm doing stuff, but I bet you use something. Okay, so what happens is you come in from infinity. You start at some level. Your potential goes down. That's the Newtonian bit. Then your angular momentum barrier goes up, and I make no promises about the accuracy of this. I'm doing it qualitatively. And then finally, you've got this minus 1 on r cubed term. So crudely speaking, this is the shape of the effective potential, possibly. Depends on the relative magnitude of terms. So if you think about what does this, you know, how do you interpret various orbits from this? If you're sitting here at this point, so in other words, you're let me first look at time like GD6. This is eta equals 1. So this would be particle orbits. Then you're sitting at a minimum. So R dot is 0. So if this is, minus 1 minus E squared. This is where the tyness comes in. So this is the zero. Essentially, when you change E, you kind of change the baseline, right? So if this is the zero of your potential, then R dot is zero and R double dot is zero because you're at, if you differentiate this equation here, you see that R double dot goes like V primed, okay? So this is actually a circular orbit. And it's stable because if you try to nudge your geodesic to a bigger R, then it wants to fall back down. And a smaller R, it wants to fall back down. Okay?
So what did you write there? Minus 1 over 1?
So it's, I'm trying to sort of sketch where the zero is. And the zero is sort of, as I put up there, it is set by the value of E. So if you change E, if you make E bigger, you're kind of translating the whole of your effective potential down. So in essence, I'm saying that this is probably not quite accurate. I think what I mean here is if this were the zero, so if this was zero and it's set by 1 minus e squared, in the sense of as you change e squared, you're basically just shifting the zero of the v, right? Because you increase e squared, v drops. So that's where the zero is set. So you kind of, if you want to know what motion is possible, you're kind of drawing a line. And I'm just going through the different possibilities here. So if this is the zero line, then you have an orbit that is circular that's just stuck there. Because if V is zero, R dot is zero. And because it's a minimum, R double dot is zero as well. So V primed is zero. And then because V double primed is positive, it's stable. Because if you try and nudge it, it always self-corrects and comes back. So if your zero was just a little bit higher, you just sketch it. So if this was your zero, for example, just a little higher, then you would oscillate between these two points. So it's just saying that that is a stable point. So similarly, if you then raised that sort of baseline, in other words, you dropped the value of E such that you were sort of sitting at this local maximum, you'd still have a circular orbit, but that would now be unstable because if R became just a little smaller, it would roll down and disappear in the black hole. And if it were just a little bigger, it would roll the other way. So you can use this effective potential and think about a ball rolling in the effector potential to give you intuition about the different orbits that are possible. So those are the circular orbits, but then, for example, if you have an elliptical orbit, is one trapped near the minimum. So that's really that brownish one there. This is an example of an elliptical orbit. The thing goes between smaller and bigger R. And then a scattering orbit would be something, let's get red for that one. So here, this might be an example of a scattering orbit. It can come in from infinity. It hits r dot equals zero there, and it turns around and goes back out again. So the shape, I mean, I've made it look very extreme there. Actually, it's doesn't really look anything like that when you put in realistic numbers. But I'm just trying to give an example of how you qualitatively see what motion is possible. So I want to just focus for a moment on the circular orbits. And the two conditions, V and V primed, are zero. So I can rearrange this to just say that H has a specific value in relation to the radius of the orbit. So we can view these two relations as constraints. We have the ability to tune E, that's sort of the energy of the particle. We have the ability to change H, the angular momentum of the particle. So in essence, if I've chosen the radius of my orbit, then that fixes for me E and H. So once I know the radius of my orbit, I can deduce what the energy of a particle orbiting there would be, as well as its angular momentum. So as we decrease the radius of this circular orbit, we're sort of changing E and M, and actually both of them decrease as we decrease the radius of the orbit. So you can kind of see that, because sort of the closer in you get, the further down the gravitational potential you are, so that sort of corresponds to E decreasing, and the closer in you get, actually your angular momentum drops. So the effect of dropping E and H in that general effect of potential is to move that maximum and minimum closer together until you get a critical value. So in other words, as you try and make stable these stable orbits get closer and closer to your black hole, eventually you hit a critical value where that maximum and minimum have merged. And if you try to go any closer in, you don't have them at all. So your potential is just sort of completely, you know, down the tunnel, so to speak. So if I look at what V double primed is, at this critical value, then
should I maybe say decreases E and H?
Yeah.
Decreasing R decreases E and H?
M, sorry.
M?
Sorry. No, you're right, actually. Shouldn't be M, should be H. You're absolutely right, thank you. That the H got a little deformed. Or else I just had a complete, you know.
I was also unclear on how decreasing R would decrease them, because R...
You kind of have to sort of see it from the perspective of the roots of this, but effectively what I was saying was that you can sort of see it in that if you have a stable orbit closer to the black hole, it's further down the potential well. So it's not, it's a bit wishy-washy, but that's sort of, you know, you're now looking at an orbit where your GTT is much lower. Yeah. So that's sort of how you might be able to at least believe me, okay, without checking, you know, in terms of calculating. In terms of H, it's kind of, it might become a little clearer when we look at the null geodesics, but quite often it's sort of paradoxical, but the further out something is, it actually tends to have a bigger angular momentum, mainly because the radius is bigger. Yeah.
Sorry, just to clarify, so when you say decreasing R, we're not sort of moving along this axis, but we're decreasing the value.
We're of the value at that, yes. Decreasing the R of the... of the circular orbit, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, here you could sort of find the roots. I mean, I've sort of turned the story into determining E and H in terms of R and M. But you could say, well, suppose I've got, you know, some given angular momentum, where can I end up? You would solve for R and, you know, and then I guess you would find E from this, given the R that solves that equation of motion. So, I mean, it's all sort of relatively simple polynomials, so you can kind of just play with them and check for yourself. But the one thing that we can do easily is actually this, this critical value of R, because we now have three constraints. So I can kind of combine this relation, V double primed is zero, with this relation here. If I multiply this one by four, I can cancel off the last term, and I get sort of 8gm on r squared minus 4gm on r squared, so that leaves me with 4gm on r squared, and then I've got minus 8 plus 6, so that's 2. So... But then I also know that I think somewhere, yes, I put the value of h squared here. And so I can combine these two because they have to be equal. And you can sort of see or argue that r equals 6gm is what allows those two different expressions to be the same. So this critical radius is called the innermost stable circular orbit, or ISCO. And it's really what characterizes the accretion disk around a black hole. So these are sort of more relevant for stellar-sized black holes. So you can get stable circular orbits up to this radius. And of course, if you think about matter being sucked into a black hole, it sort of tends to, obviously the black hole is rotating here. I've taken the Schwarzschild approximation. But things sort of start swirling in around the equatorial plane. And if this is a stellar black hole, the local tidal forces are really very high. And so the matter going in, the gas, gets very, very hot. And so you get very sort of characteristic emissions at a given temperature. And the temperature is kind of proportional to how the local tidal forces. And so this, at least in principle, gives you a way of measuring where this ISCO is, because the smaller the ISCO, the more energetic the sort of emission. So that's at least the idea. But to figure out what we see, we have to start analyzing what happens to the light coming from the black hole. So for null G of D6, eta is 0. And again, because I'm doing things sort of from a more clean analytical perspective, I'm going to rescale my affine parameter to set E equal to 1. And that's just really for convenience. So my equation of motion is the following. So my effective potential has become very, very simple. It's only got three terms. So now let me just again sketch to see what happens. So as r goes to infinity, the only term that's left is this minus 1. And then if I look at this piece, the piece that depends on r, but it's got that h squared common factor. So no matter what h squared is, the shape of that as r varies is going to be the same. And if r is 2gm, then this one of the r's cancels with the numerator there, and this term cancels with that. So at both the event horizon and infinity, my v is equal to minus 1.
So what happened to the other term, 2gm over r?
Where?
The effective potential had a 2gm over r Newtonian.
No, it's the eta. The eta multiplies it.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. It's only massive particles that feel that. Yeah. So here, so in other words, if I'm sketching my effective potential, if this is minus one, it starts off at 2gm, it starts off at minus one. At r equals infinity, it goes to minus one. Coming away from r equals infinity, it goes up first. So it goes up there. And the we sort of can deduce it's going to do something like this. Again, the precise shape is not going to look anything like that. I am sketching something to get an intuition of on what happens. Okay? So this is V, which is minus r dot squared. So everything, what happens to these null rays depends on where you set the zero. So you see there are three possibilities. You've got this one. Let's see if I can find three colors. Should have done that one as green, because then green is good. Okay, so I'm going to change my colors. Traffic light system. Okay, we've got this one. We've got that one. And then we've got this one. So these are three different possibilities for where the zero of V effective can be. And you see that this is here. I can, let me write my V effective is minus one plus h squared on r cubed into r minus 2gm. So really, it depends on the size of h as to where the zero is. So first of all, let me just establish what this critical value of h actually is. And so what I'm going to do is identify where this peak is. So V primed V-primed is now quite simple. I've just got some factor times r minus 3gm. So this maximum here, and this is why you see this is absolutely not to scale, is that r equals 3gm, and that's 2gm. So it is extremely impressionistic, this sketch. So our potential always peaks at 3gm. And then when I calculate V double primed, because we lost that eta term, we've got far fewer expressions in our effective potential. So my V double primed is always negative at this maximum. So what that means is we do have a null orbit, circular null orbit, but it's unstable. So that's the curve in orange. That's where I've chosen my h so that v is zero at the maximum. But v double primed is always negative, so that's an unstable null orbit. So it's actually quite an important radius for black hole observation. So let's just try and understand what this value of h corresponds to.
Sorry, how did you fix h squared to be 27?
That's just the value that's the critical value of h for v to be zero at the 3 GM. So you kind of, if you know that v is zero, right? If you rearrange that v effective, you've got h terms involving h squared, right? Equal one, but you know the value of r, so you plug those in, and that's what you get for h squared if v is zero. So actually the value of h is, well, you're about to see why the value of h is important. From the perspective of the null orbit, it's not so much important, but once you see what h actually means, which we're just about to do, then you'll see, you know, that it actually gives us some information. So normally when you're looking at scattering, you are interested in an impact parameter. So here I'm going to consider a null ray that's coming in from infinity, and I mean obviously it's not going to stay straight in the actual black hole space-time, but right as r goes to infinity it will be straight. So here, our x is r cos phi equals b, which is the impact parameter. So this is sort of, as you go away to infinity, you know, you could say, well, I'm going to send a light ray towards my black hole, but I'm going to sort of aim it to the right or to the left by a certain displacement, which is b. So then I simply look at the derivative of this. So this tells me that minus sine phi, phi dot, so phi, cos phi is b over r, equals minus b r dot over r squared. Now, as we go to infinity, our phi tends to pi on 2, or minus pi on 2. So this tells me that plus or minus phi dot is going to equal b r dot, sorry, plus or minus r squared phi dot is going to be b r dot. But if I look at my effective potential, my r dot tends to 1 at infinity. And so this tells me that h, r squared phi dot, is b. So I know what my h is in terms of an impact parameter of a null ray coming from infinity. So let's now, instead of sort of trying to think about, you know, unstable null circular orbits, let's look at our effective potential from the perspective of sending light rays in from infinity. In other words, what's my maximum value of B? If my maximum value of B is positive, then I'm on that green curve, and something, a light ray coming in from infinity will get to a minimum R and then be reflected back. So that's a scattering. If my maximum is negative, then that means that the minimum value of r dot squared is positive. And so my light ray comes in, it may be r dot gets lower, but then eventually it just goes right into the black hole. Yeah.
Sorry, what's our relation between r dot and h here? I know it must be somewhere on the board, but I can't, because where, yeah, how, where, what's our relation?
Well, r squared phi dot is h.
R squared phi dot.
That's way over somewhere where we talk about killing vectors.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So V of 3GM So we now kind of are starting, we know what our critical H was for this unstable null orbit, but now we're sort of seeing it from a somewhat different perspective, and we're looking at our impact parameter. So if B is bigger than 3 root 3 GM, V max is positive, so we have a scattering solution. Similarly, if B is less than 3 root 3 GM, V max is negative and the light ray is absorbed. And then if you're right on that critical value, then your light ray just gradually takes forever, spirals in and asymptotes that 3GM orbit. So we have this picture of light rays that are far enough out just get bent round, and they gradually get bent round more. But then at the critical impact parameter, they sort of asymptote and graze. Oh, not the black hole. I got carried away there, didn't I? Graze this critical value, and anything less goes into the black hole. And so this gives rise. So this is thinking about it from the perspective of light rays going into the black hole. But if you think now, what do we see when we look at a black hole on some background or in some sort of local environment that's producing photons, then we can just turn those geodesics round the other way, because any light from an astronomical object sort of meets us essentially parallel, because we're not very close to it. And so if we turn that back, we see that our black hole has a shadow. And so it's the shadow of the black hole that gets observed. So that is what the Event Horizon Telescope was observing. It was the black hole shadow. And it's really this sort of set of impact parameters where you lose your geodesic into the black hole.
I'm sorry, where did the 3 come from in the denominator when you wrote V at R and 3GM? You have, so that I think you disregarded the third term, or did you also?
No, I've combined them together because the GMs cancel, right? So you've got, yes. You've got H, if you pull the, that H, if you look at the top corner there, yeah, you've got it there. Okay. Okie doke. So that's the basic picture. I think I'm not going to start at anything new now. But of course, real black holes rotate. And I'll just write down the Kerr metric. I'm not sure if you've seen it or not. But you basically have to go through this whole story now, adding in in this Kerr metric. So so the Kerr metric introduces cross terms, which is kind of what you'd expect if something's rotating. You're going to break that time translation invariant and give a definite kind of, either you can regard it as an arrow of time or you can regard it as the direction of rotation. And so what this means is that you now get a sort of theta dependence. You've still got your phi killing vector, but you now have a theta dependence in the metric. And so your whole geodesic problem becomes more complicated. But you can still get equatorial geodesics a bit more easily, and you get this same sort of feature of the black hole shadow. So in reality, of course, what people do is ray trace for Kerr, and what you actually see depends on whether geodesics kind, these ones would come straight to you. You'll get geodesics that do one little orbit of the black hole, two, and then come to you. And this all builds up to sort of give this photon ring, as they call it, which is right sort of at the edge of the shadow. And for this, you kind of, although there's a lot of things you can do analytically, these killing vectors give you two constants. There's a third constant called a Carter constant, and you still have this this thing, the length of the tangent vector conserved. But in practice, you're going to want to actually just pop that on your favorite numerical algebraic manipulator, Maple, Mathematica, whatever, and find what the geodesics actually do. So I'm going to see Aldo, because I think a really cool homework would actually be to do, the image from Interstellar, where you see how the accretion disk looks at some arbitrary inclination. It's not that hard, but you do need to do it on a note, can't do it by pen and paper, but it's kind of cool. So I'm hoping that he can give you that he'll replace some particularly disgusting homework that there used to be with that one. Okay, I'll stop.